Hello and welcome to Radio Aldie. We're delighted to host a new podcast, The Odd Couple, sponsored by Baillie Gifford, starring the great broadcaster John Humphreys and Matthew Norman, Aldie columnist, formerly The Guardian diarist and Telegraph columnist. For over 30 years, from 1987 until 2019, John Humphreys was the chief presenter on Radio 4's Today programme. Now he and Matthew, great friends, often with severe differences of opinion, lock horns for Radio Aldie. Recording by Yamaha Music.
Hello again, this is me and this is him. Him being Matthew Norman, as if you didn't know, and I'm John Humphreys. And in this world of utter chaos and warfare and goodness knows what else, we're going to talk about something that actually doesn't affect every single person on the planet, but an awful lot of people are terribly upset about what is happening to our restaurants. Now, I confess that leaves me a little puzzled. It will not leave Matthew puzzled because he's an expert on restaurants. He made his career, God help us, in the early days anyway, writing about restaurants. Matthew, I have one question for you. Why?
Why?
Why did you decide to establish your quite extraordinary career, it has to be said, writing about restaurants?
Someone
why
asked
restaurants?
The usual way, journalist. Do you think someone asked me to?
Yeah.
And I'm greedy.
Ah,
so. That's about it. So, but most people love restaurants and like reading about them, like going. So.
Do you think?
Well, I know. But I mean, what interests me is that you have something close to a psychiatric phobia of restaurants.
Psychiatric.
It's like a disorder. So you actually...
A disorder because I don't like...
most
of
them.
Absolutely. No. Well, can I be the judge of that?
Yeah.
I mean, far be it from me to disagree with you. Good God alive, you're Matthew Norman after all. I don't hate restaurants.
Right.
I don't want to go to restaurants.
Right.
Particularly. I did go to a restaurant on Sunday night.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. A fish and chip restaurant.
Mm.
Yeah.
But you hate fancy, what you consider fancy restaurants, and you have a...
I hate the pretension of restaurants, I suppose.
Yeah. So it's hard for you to understand that the food for, I don't know, 30, 35 years has been a national obsession, in a wild swing of the pendulum away from the image of British cooking, and that people now, it's just about their main preoccupation, a lot of people, as evidenced by books and TV shows and the explosive growth of restaurants, which is now in decline.
Well, that's the point, isn't it?
Yeah.
And are they really in decline, do you think?
Yes, terror. I mean, of all the job losses that are occurring, a huge proportion are in the hospitality industry, partly because they employ young people, the minimum wage rise, and partly because people are a bit broke or worried, and restaurants are in the front line. So it's apparently appalling out there. Now, I know not every restaurant is. Lots of them are doing fine. But they're talking about a bloodbath, you know, especially when this oil price shock.
But it's only
through.
The posh restaurants that...
No,
that, no,
not at all. Right across the board. It's really hard out there. And one of the reasons it's so hard is that you will not spend money in a restaurant. If you went, you know, 4 or 5 times a week, it might turn things around a bit.
But restaurants are... Not all, of course, there are good restaurants, obvious. But too many, you'd agree with this, would you? Are pretentious, overpriced, not terribly good.
I don't think so. I think the pretension thing has gone a while ago. There was a time in the 90s and the noughties when I went to review a place in Mayfair and the dish I ordered, only for the title really, not for the food, was tail of monkfish, blah, 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 and an emulsion of Douglas firs.
Oh, as you'd expect, really.
So once you're starting to put trees on food, I think... And that was the sort of height of it.
There were no trees. I'm assuming there wasn't actually
a Douglas fir. Well, the tree had come down,
fir,
I think, but it wasn't served with the dish. And another place served the pudding with some sort of tart with Roquefort ice cream. You know, so that era was. I mean, it's great for a critic. It's not great for a diner on the whole. But of course, there's a sort of national inertia about restaurants. The English, particularly, will put up with anything. because they are terrified of complaining and they're very unsure of their own judgment.
Do you really know that, or is that just one of those... People have always said that. I've noticed that the English... I mean, I'm not English. I don't need to defend the English. You are, of course. I'm from a much more cultured and sophisticated race. I'm Welsh. But do they really complain more than anybody else?
No, less. The English.
Oh, I see. You're saying they do not complain. Ah.
They're terrified of complaining in restaurants. And you may remember the Fawlty Towers scene with the little old ladies eating the gristle.
Almost every phrase of Fawlty Towers.
And they're moaning, this is inedible. And Fawlty comes over. And, oh, very nice, Mr. Fawlty. That is the English in a restaurant. That is why restaurants, particularly outside big cities, tend to play music quite loudly. Because everyone
That's another reason for not going to
Because people
them.
Whisper. Because they're not comfortable in restaurants. It is no part of the English... Even now, it's not really an endemic part of
You're
English culture.
You're not making a very good job
out.
Of selling restaurants, which is what I thought you were going to be doing.
Well, I mean, you know, I'm not here to sell restaurants. We're here to talk about... I was much more interested in your relationship with restaurants, really.
Well, going back a little bit, this admittedly, but restaurant, a particular restaurant, nearly cost me... my career. I think I can safely say that. I was in Washington, we're not talking about English restaurants here, but I was in Washington at the time. I was a Washington correspondent for the BBC in the 1970s. And our habit, me and a couple of my colleagues in our bureau in Washington, had a routine. If nothing else was happening anywhere else in the world, or in our patch, which is, well, then, in those days, extended from the north slope of Alaska down to the southern tip of South America, our routine was to broke open a bottle. Well, actually, it wasn't a bottle of wine. It was a huge case of wine, a sort of box of wine, called Gallo Hearty Burgundy. And we'd have a very, very, very large glass or two of Gallo Hearty Burgundy, and then we'd go to the restaurant, the finest restaurant that we could find. Bear in mind, the BBC was paying in Washington. We did that on this particular day. We did exactly that, a couple of glasses of Gallo Hearty Burgundy off to the restaurant, a martini beforehand, wine with the meal, brandy afterwards, and I staggered back to the office. I think it's fair to say a little the worse for wear. And my PA greeted me with horror on her face. He said, for God's sake, you're drunk. And I said, well, I had a drink or so, I expect. Jolly good lunch. She said, yeah, fine, but we just put up, London has just booked a satellite, cost $10,000 for a satellite in those days, a 10-minute satellite, $10,000. And the reason for that is we think that Nixon is going to become the first president in the history of the world to resign. He's going to go on telly tonight. Can you stand that up and do a piece? The satellite is booked. You've got to do a piece, drunk or not. So I did. Mm. Well, obviously I did. I'm here today to tell the story. Obviously I did. But only just I managed to do my, you know, whatever, 5 minutes on the satellite, 10 minutes, whatever it was. And that was it. Didn't fall off the chair. So, yeah, it was acceptable. Following morning, I went back into the office and said to my PA, "What? No word from London. No herograms, no nothing." And she said, "No, you got away with it, but you only just got away with it." Mm. And they asked me to tell you that if it happens again, that's it.
Yeah.
Finished. Okay. So you're I stopped.
You're blaming the restaurant for forcing. I am entirely blaming
the restaurant entirely. Right. They forced the wine down my throat.
You were happy eating in restaurants when it was work-related.
Well, no,
but the idea
often.
Of wasting your own money, what I think you consider wasting, is anathema to you.
Which well, is waste in... Yes, I rather wish more people were opposed to waste. Waste is one of the seven deadly sins, or at least it should be. I don't think it is it? But it should be, shouldn't it? Of course I'm opposed to waste, obviously.
But you know, what I would consider a nice meal, you might consider an outrageous waste of money.
Well, it would depend what it was. I mean, I said I had a meal in a restaurant on Sunday night, and it was a fish and chip restaurant, specialised fish. That's all it does, is fish and chips, basically. Mm. Didn't have any wine, admittedly. And the two of us, the bill was, I don't know, 40 or 50 quid, something like that. We shouldn't, I mean, in the old days, that would have been outrageous, because you'd expect 20 quid or something, wouldn't you? But prices had gone up, I accept that. But that was basic stuff, wasn't it? I mean, anything more elaborate than a fish and chips menu, you've got to pay what? How much now? Decent meal, what you might regard, I accept that your standards are rather high, but what you might regard as a decent meal in an upmarket restaurant, two people with a drop of wine, what would that cost now?
A couple of hundred, I suppose.
Couple of hundred. How many people can afford a couple of hundred? I mean, that's outrageous, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. I was at the Turkish bars yesterday, which I may have mentioned to you over the years, and it was an extraordinary repository for some of the most bizarre people in England, from, you know, murderers to high court judges. And
so you felt entirely at home there.
And there's a guy there called Otto who has a restaurant not far from me in Gray's Inn Road in central London called Otto's. And he's telling me how it's tough at the moment. He said, but people are buying the big ticket items. And I thought it'd be a good place for you to go maybe for your birthday, because they do a burger. I think it's £3,600.
What?
Yeah.
Oh, but that's a joke, isn't it?
I mean, it's got gold leaf and beluga caviar and everything.
Hang on a minute. Yeah. You eat the gold leaf?
Yeah.
Why?
I don't know. Just the ostentation, really, and decadence and last days.
Doesn't that rather make my case?
Yeah. But this guy, it's one of anyone who's got a great deal of money or a very rich uncle or on a very fat expense account, Otto's in the Gray's Inn Road. It's the most bizarre restaurant and one of the most glorious I've ever been to.
Glorious?
But, yeah, it's magnificent. But I'd like to go with you. But we'd have to have a full paramedic crew and the defibrillator paddles on standby,
because we probably,
at the first sight of the menu, you would go into some kind of cardiac event.
Let's try.
That's where you want to take you there, and it's a kind of euthanasia.
Let us be a teeny weeny bit serious. Can a meal in a restaurant ever be worth? You're going to say
philosophical questions, isn't it?
Like, no, it isn't. It's
a painting. Can a painting be worth £100 million? You know.
I'll tell you the difference. You raised the question, you buy the painting, £100 million. I don't buy many paintings for £100 million, but nonetheless, you buy a painting, you can see it, admire it every day of your life for the rest of your life, live. With a meal, you go there, you stuff it down your throat, and you're trying to think this is worth the money,
it's the same. Is it worth spending £300 to see a band that you love, you know, to Oasis Reunion or whatever, or whatever they're charging, $2.4 million for a ticket.
The difference is that...
It's for the pleasure and the memory, and you're not really by nature, and I hope you won't take grave umbrage, I wouldn't describe you as a hedonist.
I think I'm not a hedonist. I think I'm probably not.
I don't know what the opposite of a hedonist is. Grumpy old boss, old fucker.
How about tight ass? Not in many respects, have to say, I'm...
But you
quite
do.
Prepared to spend a lot of money on a lot of things. But
charity,
not
yes.
That.
Obviously on your charity and your children. But spending money is not easy for you, is it? On anything other than
I've said on this podcast before, I was born into great poverty and I've never got over it.
I would accept that. Right, and I'm going to come over a bit sort of faux psychiatrist or something.
Not you, surely.
The reason you're happy, the only place you'd be happy eating in now is a fish and chip restaurant, is because that was the only thing from outside the home that you would eat as a kid.
That is absolutely true.
Yeah.
And that... That wasn't actually outside the home. It was brought into the home. Came from outside. You had to go
and
buy it from the fish and chip shop wrapped in newspaper.
So you're not betraying your past.
Once a week, if you're lucky. Yeah.
You're not betraying your past by eating in a fish and chip restaurant. Whereas if you eat in somewhere where it's 46 quid for a piece of leaven sole... To you, that is like a betrayal of everything that you grew up with, and it's like almost like class treachery, I think.
Ooh,
what do you think?
I think that's
now that you're on the couch.
Well, it's partly that. Mm. It's partly also that. It's going to sound too sanctimonious, but I've spent a very large part of my career working in third world countries, specifically sub-Saharan Africa, and seeing real poverty.
Yeah.
I mean, at the side of the road, woman with a tiny baby, newborn baby, trying to feed the baby and not succeeding because she had no milk in her breast, because she was starving and the baby was starving. And within the time I was over, the film crew obviously when we went to help, it was no point because she was they were both, and they both died within a matter of hours. Now, when you see poverty like that, it does something to you, I think.
That's certainly, I mean, anyone would understand that. But I suspect that your hatred of spending money predated your time in sub-Saharan Africa. It may have exacerbated it. And I went as a small boy to Tanzania, and that sort of shaped my entire political outlook at the age of
I set up a charity because of what I saw in Tanzania.
I mean, you've never seen anything like it. Well, I hadn't, obviously, at that age, and it made an indelible impression. But I suspect that your I don't know what the word is, but I think you are phobic about spending money when you think it's flippant sort of spending money.
Well,
I've never met anyone. I mean, you're a wealthy man. You've earned a great deal of money and you've given most of it to your charities. But I've never seen anyone who has lower living costs than you, ever.
I don't waste.
You could be on food stamps. You'd be thinking of luxury.
Not quite.
Luxury.
not entirely.
As long as you've got your lentils. so you're the worst person in the world to take to a restaurant.
All right. Here's your literally task. In the next few minutes, you now have to persuade me. This is your job now for the purpose of this podcast. Not me, our listeners. What constitutes a good restaurant, somewhere where you can go for a meal and you will walk out of the restaurant saying to yourself and your friend or friends, that was worth the money.
Yeah.
What is it?
Question. Well, when I was reviewing for those many years...
Yeah, which you did for a long time,
20-odd years, a bit more maybe. I always said that my reviews were not exclusively or mainly about the food, because the food is less than half the battle of the restaurant. There are restaurants... Well, yeah, I mean, there are restaurants that serve the most fantastic food, but because, they come and sort of dab at your mouth if you have a stain and replace your handkerchief, your napkin every time. You know all that when it's... And because the lighting's bad or the acoustic's bad or whatever the reasons, you don't really feel comfortable, you don't relax. It doesn't matter how great the food is, and there are restaurants that serve nice but not brilliant food.
Can I interrupt for 1 second? Because I went to a restaurant called... 3 weeks ago, and my napkin was retrieved because it had slipped off my knee 3 times.
Right.
And each time I got a crisp, white, brand new napkin put on my... I hated it.
Can you think of the water that was used to wash those perfectly clean napkins? I know, and people hate that. And
I hated it. It spoiled it for me.
You've pretty much got to wipe people's noses if they sneeze. It's disgusting and awful. So,
all right, so what's good then? Tell me what a good restaurant is. Where would you spend a lot of money?
You don't have to spend a lot of money.
Right.
I used to, even when I was, perhaps because I was spoiled, because I was being paid to eat in all the fanciest places, but I was like local places that for whatever alchemy, it is like alchemy. You don't really know. It's like, the famous William Goldman quote about the movies. In Hollywood, no one knows anything. And it's a bit like that with restaurants. You can have a perfect site, a perfect this, and a perfect chef, a perfect maitre d', and it just doesn't click.
Really?
And there are sites, graveyard sites, where restaurant after restaurant fails, almost like a feng shui thing.
Well, because of the site, because of where it is?
Because of there's something wrong with it, and it's not always obvious what it is, but people, it's just unnerving or it's not relaxing. So, the best restaurant, my favourite restaurants are cheerful local places where...
Well, hang on. Local is a slightly odd word because it depends where you are to be local. I mean...
Well, I was thinking local to me rather than local to someone I don't know in Brussels.
Quite so.
Or Ulaanbaatar.
But you're living in the middle of London.
Well, not quite, but yeah.
Well, pretty much.
But they've gone. The ones I love, they've all gone because it's impossible. No one can park and the rates are hideous and the rents are hideous.
Really? So, they've all gone?
It's very hard to be a small, independent, local restaurateur now, and has been for a long time.
But, yes, and you could argue always has been. Opening a new restaurant has always been a gamble.
Apart from buying a racehorse, there's no quicker way to lose a lot of money, I think, probably.
Or betting on...
And products. Everyone thinks they can do it at restaurants, because, there are things everyone can do, right? Everyone could be a TV critic. I know I've done that, too. If you like, tell you. And everyone can be a restaurant critic because, if you like food and you like being rude about things.
Or if you don't like
food. Or if you hate food. Or if you hate spending money. Or whatever. But very few people are any good at running a restaurant and making money at
it. So what's the trick?
I don't know. I've not done it. But, I mean, you've got to be unbelievably...
Well, you do know in the sense that you were a critic for a long time.
I know that you have
critic.
To get some things right, right? You the lighting, which is one of the greatest mistakes.
Really?
Over lighting. If you think you're... If it feels like you're in a Damascus interrogation cell and people are about to strap electrodes to your testicles, you're not going to relax, right? So, but over bright lighting is catastrophic. Terrible acoustic, it kills everything if you can't hear because it's bouncing, you know, off the wall.
Or because there's music coming.
Well, they
out.
As I say, the music's usually to disguise the quietude of the whispering customers. I used to have this thing called the whispering quotient, the WQ, and it doesn't really apply in London or Manchester or big cities, but you go to a provincial town or a rural restaurant, and that's what I'm talking about. No one really wants to be there. No one really, it's not part of their culture. So they're sitting there and they're nervous and they're whispering or not talking at all. That's why these poor souls have to play, you know, and some of the music. I was in a place in the New Forest once, like a hotel restaurant, and they were playing, I think it was Mozart's Requiem, but to a stock Aitken Waterman drum beat, like as on Kylie Minogue's.
Sounds glorious.
You know, I Should Be So Lucky. And you think, what the fuck's wrong with these people? Are they insane? But then you, okay, it's a bad choice, but because they're all sitting there and no one's talking and no one's enjoying themselves, it's an ordeal. Even now, for a lot of people, going to a restaurant is an ordeal rather than a pleasure.
I'm glad I'm not the only one.
Well, yeah. But I don't think you'd be backward and complaining like a lot of these people. But, I mean, I can feel your... We went to a restaurant a few weeks ago around here in central London, and I could feel the hackles, almost like you were stiffening up as you walked in.
Or me?
Yeah, it's like it's an instinctive reaction. You don't want to be there. Hmm. Fish and chips...
And
just,
I was right about that particular restaurant. Well, I couldn't eat the meal because it was about 90% salt and 2% something else.
Yeah, your blood pressure's fine. You could afford it. You'd have, if you had a
I
stroke,
don't like salty
if you had
food,
a stroke from it, it would have been a small one and you would have recovered.
Well, that's reassuring, I think.
It was salty.
It was terrible. Anyway.
But listen, I understand. If you've grown up in poverty like you did, not quite Tanzania, but, you know, by British standards, absolutely abject poverty, the idea of spending £200 or £300 on some very average food is anathema, and it should be.
Ah,
it should be. There are a lot of restaurants that are not good. You know, it's a bit like companies. You have a recession, it's supposed to wipe out the bad ones.
So aren't you destroying your own argument a bit? I mean,
no, because a lot of good restaurants will go as well.
And, all right, define a good restaurant.
Well, a restaurant that serves nice food in a nice environment, yeah, like nice people, but well-lit, good acoustic. Makes the ultimate thing, do you feel jollier leaving it than you did arriving? That's a very simplistic test.
Well, it's too dramatic, really, isn't it? Because you'll probably, I think, in my case, sometimes, obviously, I've had a restaurant and I have lots. I would go for months, I mean literally months, 3 months on one occasion, when I ate every meal.
Yeah.
Breakfast, lunch and dinner in a restaurant because I was based abroad. I didn't go home. I was...
But that was like... It was almost like you're going to a canteen in that case. It's part of your work. And it wasn't your money. It was BBC's money. It was my money and a licence payer. Defrauding the licence payer.
I don't think defrauding because I had
no
choice.
You drank about $300 worth of bourbon on the day Nixon resigned.
I think fraud requires a degree of malicious intent and there was... I had no choice. I had to eat somewhere, for God's sake.
No. Well, maybe we should have an experiment.
Go on.
I'll find a restaurant, we'll go halves, and you have to sit there and not complain about it for 2 hours.
I'll do that.
Good food, but it will cost you, let's say, £80 and upwards.
What? So we're going to spend...
But I'd like to see your... It would be a test more of your self-control than your appetite.
But I have eaten in restaurants that... are infinitely more expensive than that. I mean, obviously I have. Either on expenses or... I have paid for some expensive meals.
You're 82, right? So you've been of eating out age for more than six decades. So if I say, well, what's your favourite restaurant meal or get name if you... I'd be... that you've paid for.
What are you asking me? What is my...
In the last 62 years, right?
In the last 62 years, yeah.
Remember a restaurant that you really liked?
Oh, there have been many. Okay. But I can't remember. Of course, I can't. I barely remember my name.
See, I can. I can remember, as a kid, the best food I've ever eaten, even now, and I've been eating out for more than 50 years, because it was part of our culture as a family that we went out to restaurants.
What was it?
It's a Chinese restaurant in Willesden Green, which is a nice but not fancy, not expensive, well, then not part of northwest London, where we lived when I was young, a young child. And there was a Chinese restaurant called Kuai Yan that we later discovered was actually set up by the Chinese state as a cultural thing. So they had unbelievable chefs. And it was just a grubby road next to the Working Man's Club. Really quite rough, not desperately dangerous, but not fancy, as I said. And the food, Pekingese food, as we called it then, was beyond belief.
Still not sure.
Never found anything like it since.
Really?
Yeah. And I've spent 30, 40 years trying to recreate the hot and sour soup. I could have bought a mansion in Monaco for what I've spent on dried mushrooms in that time and increasingly fancy vinegars and sesame oils and things. And there's just something missing. Again, it's like alchemy. There's just one tiny thing, one drop of something that would make it gold. But it, most of the time, it's still...
Can I observe that that sounds on the face of it a wee bit pretentious?
Does it? Mm. Oh, well, fair enough. I'll take it. But, so that was, you know, that... And there are loads of restaurants, you know, that I've loved down the years. And it's been one of the joys of my life, as it is for a lot of people.
What's the worst?
Oh, my word. What a... Well, there was a... I mean, there are so many hilariously bad ones. But I do remember one in... I can't remember where it was. I think it was East London. And it was... I don't know, I don't remember what the food was, but I remember I went with my friend and colleague Marina Hyde, you know, who everyone knows, the greatest writing journalist in Christendom. She was then my lovely assistant on The Guardian Diary, and she'd go on reviews with me, because I can't remember where it was reviewing, maybe the Sunday Telegraph. And we went, and we sat in a giant amphora. I mean, it was just wildly silly, in this restaurant in... I don't know where it was.
I'm not sure I know what the amphora...
An amphora is like a Greek jug.
I see what you mean. Yeah.
It was styled after
that. Oh, it looked like that. Yeah.
Anyway, the food was terrible and we didn't eat much of it. And the guy came over and said, he said, you haven't finished. I said, no, it wasn't great. He said, well, chef does like people to finish their thing. I said, well, I'd like to have a full head of hair and a washful stomach, but that's not going to happen either. Would you please take it away? So, I mean, there was one with used condoms in the loo on the floor. And, I mean, loads of... But as a critic, you crave those. Because it's a lot easier.
Of course, you've got something to write
about. It's very hard to be funny when everything's great. So I'm trying to think what the... I mean, there are some terrible... I never actually got hospitalised. But I'd have taken that. I'd have taken 3 days in intensive care with gastroenteritis just for the review. There was one called Shepherd's. Do you remember Shepherd's in Westminster? You must have been.
I do.
Awful, pompous, ghastly place. MP sort of nursery food. Sort of shepherd's pie and steak and kidney pud. Gruesome place. Hacks and journalists and tourists.
That's right.
And I wrote this review. And this, I think, was in about a year and 18 months after the invasion of Iraq. So 2004-ish. And I wrote this review, and I can't remember what the... I think it was a lobster bisque, you know, a soup. Sort of lobster and brandy soup. And I said that if this was found in a can... Even now, if this bisque was found in a canister beneath the deserts of Iraq, it would get Tony Blair off the hook. Anyway, there's various other elegances of the kind. The guy, Peter Shepherd, sued. He was announced that he was going to sue. So this became a little cause célèbre. Can you sue a food critic for, you know, or just fair comment?
Well, it answers itself. Of course you can't.
Well, since then, there have been cases.
No.
Yeah.
Successful cases?
Yeah, I think one of them was.
A restaurant
obviously
critic?
Obviously, if you lied about... Technically, it was not a weapon of mass destruction, the bisque. Obviously, it was attemptedly funny hyperbole. Anyway, the guy... and the editor of the paper, Dominic Lawson, just put the whole thing on the whole of pastry, this... sensibly, and he went
I wonder
away.
If he'd said, eat this food and you will die because it's poisonous.
I think that would be beyond fair comment. It was unfair comment.
So your best restaurant? Best meal? You told me that the Chinese meal.
No, that was the best food I've ever eaten.
Okay.
But then six-year-old palate is probably much more... you know, absorbent and excitement than a 56-year-old.
I was going to ask you, that was going to be my final question.
Was it?
Yes, I mean, you're going to die in another year or two or something or less or whatever. This is an assumption.
You're not actually giving a prognosis.
No.
Oh, you're very kind.
No, I'm not. What would you choose? in the
like
huge...
like a death row final meal.
Yeah, that'll do it.
Do you know, I go for the footballer special, really. It's like that from the 70s.
What, steak and chips?
Actually, no, I wouldn't. Not prawn cocktail. I'll have a dozen snails in, laden with garlic butter and fresh baguette bread, right? And then a great fat rump steak au poivre with a pepper sauce and chips and a green salad, and then profiteroles. Comforting way to... What about yours? Fish and... have to be fish and chips.
It would probably be a version of fish and chips. I do like
but
fish.
But you can have three courses on death row. So, lentil soup?
No, I eat lentil soup because I've got this weird, weird, weird approach to diet. It is new, I confess, in the last 20 years or something. That I want to feel when I'm eating, whether it's in a restaurant or anywhere else, I want to feel that the food is doing me no harm. What is that first do no harm? That is the
It's the thing that isn't in the Hippocratic Oath.
It's the Hippocratic Oath.
But it's not, I know what you mean.
Precisely. First do no harm. And I want to feel that, not necessarily, that I don't want it all to be broccoli or something, but nonetheless, I want to feel at the end of that meal that it has done me no harm. So
you don't eat a lot of uranium or you know, cesium then.
I mean, most
food, you know, so everything nice is going to be almost everything, except your daughter is...
I was about
a great vegan chef.
I was about to give her a plug. I was about to say...
Give her a plug.
My daughter is Catherine Humphreys. She is a vegan chef, makes a living from being a vegan chef, and is brilliant. And I was hugely sceptical when she became a vegetarian when she was a little girl. And I had a farm in Wales then, and a farmer, a local farmer, was getting a bit cross about all the rabbits on my land, and he asked me if he could come and shoot some, and I said no problem, and I went came back a few hours later and my daughter was in tears, and I said, what's the matter? She said, well, this man, she was about 11, 12 maybe, this man came at the door and holding a rabbit which was covered in blood, and he shot it and he thrust it in my hand and he said, give that off to other love, and off he went. And she has never
eaten. Reminding me of a film.
Never eaten meat ever since that day.
Quid pro quo, Clarice. When did the lamb stop screaming, Clarice? When did the rabbits fall quiet, Clarice? So anyway, so that was a trauma, but one that gave her a career that she
gave her
brilliant.
A brilliant career.
It's very hard to. It's easy to make things nice with lots of cream and sugar and stuff, but it's very hard.
But just to go back to that, and we should, this is a diversion really, but we can always cut it out. I'm surprised that a big rump steak is, I mean, steak is boring, isn't it?
Well,
I mean, I can see that it's beautifully cooked.
It's the pepper sauce. Anyway, let's not dwell on that.
No.
So your death row meal is going to be the meal that you probably have twice a week anyway.
It's not twice a week. In the winter, it's probably 7 days a week.
That's good then. So you're going to go out, you're going to die as you lived, eating fish and chips. Nothing is going to make you have lobster or caviar or something.
I like lobster. I'm not mad. I can't quite see the point of caviar. It just tastes a bit salty and that's that really. But no, lobster. I like lobster.
I think that says it all about you.
What?
And whether it's good or bad or both, I'm not sure. That your death row meal would be your almost, you know, daily meal. You're going to keep up your standards and your rhythm and your routine to the very last as they lead you down the green mile.
Look, all I can say is...
With vinegar dripping off your chin and chip fat all over your death row smock.
I do like vinegar. But that means I'm not a whatever you are. How would you describe it?
What?
I mean, you're an aficionado. What are you?
I'm greedy, is what I mean.
Certainly that, but in terms of your appreciation of food, where are you on that scale?
Oh, I'm not. I like good food, but I'm not. You know, I wouldn't walk 6 miles for a kind of cherry tomato from Tirana or something. I'm not obsessive. I like good simple food.
Right. So, go back to where we began. Is the restaurant dead?
No, not yet. It's under huge pressure. I mean, there have been restaurants since there's been civilizations, haven't there? You know, in ancient Rome, you could go out to eat and before. So it's not like it's going to die out as a thing. It's just going through, I think, probably the hardest times that it's ever been through in our
really?
Lifetime. Well, I think the war was probably a bit of a blow to the business, unless you were a fan of the Spam Fritter.
Quite.
But no, it's incredibly hard, and the cost of eating out now is insanity, you know. I went out with friends a couple of months ago to some nice Greek Cypriot place in North London, where, you know, and a perfectly normal meal with a bit of wine was £100 each. I mean, it was just, it's deranged. Oh. I mean, somewhere in this is a pointer to the structural problems with the economy and the fact that people are not paid enough to live. And now, when they're being paid a little more, closer to a living wage, it's passed on to the consumer and it becomes, you know, untenable. And we have massive structural problems and the price of eating out is... But it's the same in America. It's worse. You could pay $25, apparently, for a sandwich in Manhattan now. I mean, it's even more crazy.
But maybe if restaurants decided to be a little less pretentious, maybe that would satisfy me.
I mean, I think for you, what's pretentious for you isn't pretentious for everyone. Pretentious for you is pretty much anything that isn't cod and chips.
That's entirely not true, but
I mean, you probably consider rock salmon pretentious or a lemon sole fillet pretentious.
I rather like lemon sole.
Okay. Or langoustines and things. So, you know, your definition of pretentious food is...
No, absolutely not. No, you're completely wrong about that. You're talking about the content of the food. I'm talking about everything that surrounds the presentation of the food.
Well,
that stuff.
Yeah, no, there is a lot of nonsense.
Hmm.
But there are a lot of very good, unpretentious restaurants that are going to go bust. And
do you think?
It's a brutal time. And we haven't even seen this oil shock really filter through into food prices yet, but it will.
All right, so there's only one left only one restaurant left in London, and you get to go to it for your last restaurant meal, because it's about to close, and you know what I'm going to say. Describe it. This is the perfect restaurant that has survived
and
all
I'm about to die. It's the last one.
You may or may not be about to die, but the restaurant is about to close. And
if I was about to die, I think it should serve heroin cocktails, liquid diamorphine.
No, you're cheating.
And grapefruit juice. It would be a lovely warm... I mean, there was a Polish place near me, and I got friendly with the owner over the years, a lovely woman who fled, you know, communism, and used to get her phone calls monitored by secret police. She tried to ring her mother, and she opened this Polish place. It was three courses with a shot of vodka, coffee and water, $9.95. That's going back 30 years. But this was a magnificent restaurant, and it looked like the sitting room of a educated person in Krakow in about 1930, samovars and a piano. And it was like walking into someone's home and just overwhelmed by the hospitality. You know, if I went with a friend who had some gastric condition, she did three vegetables for her that weren't on the menu that she could eat. You know, that's the perfect restaurant, isn't it?
Ah, I'm delighted you said that, because if your perfect restaurant is like going into somebody's home, why don't you just eat that same food, which you'd be able to cook, in your own home?
I wouldn't be able to cook. I can't cook Polish food. And also, it's not the same experience, is it? I hope this isn't too subtle a point, but eating where you eat all the time, alone, is slightly different from eating in a place that you're not familiar with.
Of course it is.
Surrounded by other people.
But eating... I've eaten in your house many times, and if I may say so, you are not a bad cook.
I mean,
you take it quite seriously, don't you? And it's your food is very good food. And if I had the choice between eating in a restaurant eating in your home, I would choose to eat in your home.
Listen,
it's free,
if I can end on this
else.
With this very, very gracious offer to you, God forbid, you know, that time is drawing close, I will certainly have you for your last meal.
We'll have
your solicitor there, be redrafting your will at the table between courses. But I would be delighted to serve you your last meal. And if you want a nudge on the way, I will sprinkle your parsnips with hemlock. How's that? I can't make a more generous offer.
Will the hemlock be grilled or lightly fried?
I think, well, leave that to me. That would be the chef's little surprise.
So you're happy to cook my last
meal? I'd be delighted, and the sooner the better, to be honest. If you could arrange it for the middle of next week, I'd be delighted.
Thank you.
Except you're going to outlive me by a good 15 years.
Because I eat so healthily.
You eat bleeding lentils and you don't drink. But if, God forbid, if the day comes, that offer is open and you're very welcome.
And I hope all our listeners will keep you to that.
I'm sure they will.
And on that, I think, cheery note, goodbye from Matthew and me.
Yes, goodbye. Speak to you next time.
You have been listening to Radio Aldie, brought to you by Bailey Gifford. Why not get 3 trial issues of the Aldie magazine for just £1? Sure you'll enjoy it. We'll then charge you £25.75 for every 6 issues. Just go to checkout.theoldie.co.uk/offers and enter old trial as one word in capitals. That's checkout.theoldie.co.uk/offers and enter old trial.